Hey guys, welcome to Parallax. So good to see you. Alexander's got a new book up, Process and Event. We just did a wonderful course at Parallax with Benita, and we're merging worlds here. So where do you guys want to start? Where would you like to begin?
I want to start with my curiosity about Benita Roy's work. So I associate Benita Roy with Taoism and with Alfred North Whitehead, like if she was Whitehead's daughter. And I wanted to explain, at least for my followers who are now discovering Benita Roy, I want them to understand where she's at and what motivates her. So Benita, you start. Where's your work at and what motivates you?
What motivates me? You know, I was going to ask you kind of the same thing, because a lot of times I'll watch people and I think that they're doing really beautiful things and creating beautiful glossaries and stuff. And I'm like, but what's their path? What's motivating them? Like, what's their, yeah. And so for me, it's two things. I would say that it's a lifelong irritation with what is doctrine or sutra or science doesn't seem to resonate with the edge of my own exploration. And this was something that happened when I was young. I was in grammar school. I went to Catholic grammar school. It was horribly underfunded. I taught the science and math courses from sixth grade on, because what was being taught to me, that it could tell that people didn't know what they were talking about. So I've always been at this edge of, so that's the irritation piece. I was in a PhD program at the UCal San Francisco many, many, many years ago. And I failed in my attempt to write a PhD thesis on the fact that I thought the speed of light was actually perspectival. I didn't say it that way at the time, and not a hard constraint in the universe, but had something to do with the way we composed our orientation toward these metaphysical terms, blah, 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 blah. So that motivates me. And the other thing that motivates me is, you know, I was at my mom's house the other day, and she has all my old books. And, you know, I've been reading about environmental destruction and extinction, and reading David Orr and Peter Matthiessen in Orion magazine. I started reading that from the very beginning, and Barry Ehrenfeld, and you know, and I was looking through some of the books, and it's like the situation hasn't changed. Like the intellectual understanding or the grip of reality hasn't changed, and everything has just gotten worse. And in a way, there's a lot of despair there, because I could go, you know, I had this urge to sit down and read the old books again. But there's this.
So you seriously thought when you were younger that things would get better during your lifetime?
I don't know if I actually had that thought. I remember once having a thought that that I thought the external world was going to shit, but there was a possibility to live with a group of people in a bubble. And then this was in college when I was maybe a freshman, and then I realized the bubble's not possible. I mean, there's no boundary between you and the rest of the world. No, I don't think I was ever an optimist in that sense, mostly in shock of the human condition. So that's what motivates me. Could go on and on and on, but so one's kind of an irritation, and one is kind of a despair or a sadness. Or, you know, the other side of despair and sadness is for love of the gifts of existence and the gifts of this world. You know, we have all this, and we haven't done anything to deserve it. And kind of trying to put more of that sense of what it's like to be a human being into the equation. And that, of course, depends upon these metaphysical constraints we have, these mental models. You can't let that in if you're constrained by certain mental models. So that's why it matters to me. How about you?
How about me? I knew I would be an artist. So I was the drama guy at school. I did well with everything else. Academics was fine. I did the maths and science and all that, but it was all about the arts for me. And then I discovered that as a young guy, I would probably be nice to myself by allowing my impulse control to be short. And then probably I could gradually become more patient about what I did. That was clever, actually, to find that out when you're a teenager. So I went into the music industry and had 25 really successful years and wrote hit records and filled up the bank account. It was actually selling a record company in the 1990s that gave me fuck-off money, so I could actually say no to anything I didn't want to do the rest of my life, which is what money is all about. It's not a fetish. Money is all about the freedom you can have from having the money. So I learned that, and that was great. And it was after that, in my 30s, that I thought the songwriting thing wasn't enough of a challenge. I started with drama. I started with theater in my teens. That was too old-fashioned, you know, grumpy and dusty and playing to the same audience 400 times over, 400 nights in a row, when television had happened, you know, and we were moving into onto the internet. So I love technology. I was probably one of the first totally electronic music producers, right? Used machines for everything. So I was a gadget guy. And then I realized that writing, of course, I knew I would write sooner or later. I was like 8 years old when both my parents and my teachers told me, oh, anybody could put a pen onto a paper the way you can always support themselves. So I had that self-confidence when I was a kid that I would write. I didn't know I would write. I wouldn't write novels. I started with drama, sort of left it, never wanted to do poetry. And then I discovered that, of course, it was all about philosophy. And then the first thing you think when you do philosophy and you fall in love with it, it's just like, honestly, is there anything for me to say that hasn't been said by all these smart guys already? And this was also the 1990s that I had discovered female philosophy that exploded in the 20th century. And that was a new voice, which I couldn't be part of, but that I found very interesting. I loved female philosophers. So there was a whole new spectrum opening up. And then in the late 1990s, when I had the fuck off money and I was offered to teach whatever I wanted at the Stockholm School of Economics, and I was an economist by training just to have some kind of academic merit, I realized that I was going to write books and I was going to do philosophy properly. And I realized, to me, the 20th century had been wasted on some kind of navel-gazing. This is Europe. I live in Europe. So this was like navel-gazing continental philosophy. I had gone into literature studies and deconstruction to the extreme, whereas actually the whole 20th century it had two world wars. We confronted with a bomb. Existential risk was real. And at the same time, we were in the middle of a technological explosion. And somewhere in between Hegel and Whitehead and Marshall McLuhan, I discovered that nobody's really, besides McLuhan, nobody's really doing properly philosophy on the relationship between man and machine, which is what philosophers should do. And there I discovered what always motivated me, was motivated for all the six books I've written with John Sedeckis, is every time before we write a book, we take about a year, and then we sit down and we look at the world map, and then we decide that wherever we're looking on the map, we would be the best guys to dig into something and be motivated about it and write about it. We should do that. What would be the one thing we could probably do better than anybody else right now in the world? And let's try to do that, because that's totally motivating. And that's motivating me towards writing all the six books I did beyond. And I guess that's why I'm a philosopher. So it's philosophy is an art form that's absolutely essential to me. It's art. It's a literary art form. It's kind of the poet and the philosopher like opposites fighting each other, like two nasty twins to each other, because the poet wants to expand language infinitely. Right? Whereas the philosopher is like, I use whatever words I have and try to give the meaning and try to nail the word world with words. Although I know it's impossible to nail the world with words, I will still try to do it. So that motivated me.
Yeah. So just to ping off of that. So for me, I graduated with a degree in science and I started to work in a neuroscience lab and found that I had too many questions about like the experimental setup and what was I doing with my life. And then I went to get a PhD and philosophy. And then I entered into a pretty hardcore art scene, first with people at the Art Institute in San Francisco. And then we started making these art sculptures that we sold to Disney, me and some people, and moved to New York, and we had a scene there. But the opposite happened to me. We were basically on a trajectory to be homeless. And we were burning through a lot of money. And that's when I ended up getting a career in landscape design, starting in New York City in interior lobbies and all these big displays and stuff, and then moving out to the country. So, and then after when the recession hit, I left my firm here in Connecticut and then started going back to trying to write. Writing is very difficult for me. It's a lot of work for me to compose a few good paragraphs. So let me.
By the way, those are two dogs fighting. It's not me and Nita fighting it out.
Yeah.
Where are the dogs?
There's always babies and dogs in these podcasts. Like at the beginning, around 8 o'clock, my child goes to bed and destroys the first part of the conversation. Then
Nina's dogs are calling out in the woods. And so then they get into the scene. But anyway, so that's our background. And that's why it matters.
So what brought you to the most difficult thing of everything, which is metaphysics? Because people don't understand. They don't understand what metaphysics is, and they don't understand how fiendishly difficult it is to do.
Well, I think for me, it's just kind of the way my mind works. I used to have a perspective on, okay, so I was 3 years old, my mom taught me how to pray because my sister was five, she went to school. And we kneel down and we go like this, and my mom says, "Say, now I lay me down to sleep," whatever. And I think, this is weird. You use words to talk to God? Like, I already knew that words were kind of like coarse grain transmitters that people had to use. And that when you talk to God, there was kind of this direct open communication path. And I thought, this is really weird, you know? And then she said, and then I had to say, "I'm sorry that I hit my sister." I'm like, now I have to lie to God? You know, so like, well, from very early on, there was always this kind of like reality that, you know, for a while I thought, okay, I'm young, pretty soon she'll know that I can operate as an adult. And then you realize that they don't know they're not operating as with a sense of transparency between language and reality or lived experience, and then, you know, certain types of transformative experiences I've had many before I even started reading Eastern philosophy, and all this kind of other kind of journey I was on while I was walking through the real world. And also very cultural codes were very transparent to me. You know, I was valedictorian and at senior athlete of the year. So that was the first time a woman was senior athlete of the year. And I used to go to basketball camp with the boys team, and all these cultural codes that were broken. And then when I went to college, I went to a private college on a scholarship, and I was very naive. I had never actually slept outside of my own room. My mom wouldn't let us go sleep over someone else's house. And here I was, and everybody there, they'd been to prep school. And all of a sudden there was this like whole cultural code that I was like, what is this, you know? And I realized that there were all these kind of ways that people were gaming the college thing because they'd been to prep school, and there was a whole cultural code. And then I remember by the time I was a junior, I realized the teachers had a cultural code, and there was this whole game behind the game. And so I've always, like, there's always been this, what I would call, transparency between a patina or a something, this reality, and then something that seemed not attainable or achievable. I didn't have to go find the other reality. I didn't have to go sit in a Zen monastery. It was always there, evaluating, I would say. Yeah, evaluating or referencing things to this other reality that seemed more precious, more kind, even, you could say. Could go back to, you know, watching people and how they treated their animals when I was a kid, more aware, more open, more free. You know, I've always been someone like who's done things in very unique ways, starting my own businesses. And with the advent of the internet, I taught myself the internet and made our own job costing things. And I always wanted to, like, I always had this feeling like I just wanted the state and the system just stay off my fucking back. I mean, it was just always right there. So I'm a big,
you're a shamanoid. You're clearly
I'm a
shamanoid
big
personality.
Junkie.
Yeah,
you're shamanic personality for sure.
Well, it's interesting. Like the people who come and talk here and the people that we have conversations with. There's a similar story. There's this intersection between, you know, being involved in the arts for a while, being involved in edgy spirituality and of some kind, being, you know, so it's philosophy. I'm getting all these this sort of a similar story or similar trajectory behind two people who are also extremely different and also a different motivation as well in some sense.
But
like your motivation seems to come from like this world is fucked up and Alexander's motivation seems to be like Napoleon ready to conquer the
no, not really, but the point here is I want to talk about philosophy though. I think everybody goes to Parallax knows what kind of people look for Parallax, so thanks for pointing that out, Andrew, by the way. Shamanoid person, this is like a gay club for gays who come from the countryside and finally discover there are the gays in the cities. It's a bit like shamanoids finally discovered that the shamanoids because they went online. So we're shamanoid, right? But my point here is that what I was missing in 20th century philosophy, where the 20th century was almost completely wasted, except for Whitehead and Deleuze, was that it didn't do metaphysics. And probably was this huge disappointment because Christianity was over. It was always assumed that metaphysics and religion had to be this one of the same thing or whatever. Whereas metaphysics is the ultimate horizon for our thinking. That's what it is. And what it did was that it did escape and it came back in two different forms that we in hindsight now have to regard as philosophical disciplines. And this is what I love about Bonita, because Bonita points us towards psychoanalysis and anthropology. The way you describe your experiences was anthropological, but then you realize besides anthropology could also be another world, and that's where you discover metaphysics. And this is why I say the two great fields of conquest in thinking in the 20th century were psychoanalysis and anthropology. And I use both. I'm a child of both, and we have to regard them as philosophical disciplines today because that's where philosophy should be, especially if we live in a an era of enormous change. And we live in between worlds, as Zach Stein perfectly has pointed out. That's where we have to be. And you know, obviously, since you're familiar now with Process Event here, Bonita, you know that I'm deeply, deeply devoted to Freud, Lacan, Kristeva, female psychoanalysis, Jung, certainly. There'll be more Jung in the future, actually, than there is now. And then, of course, all the great anthropologists. And that's what I discovered in the last 10 years, is that we cannot understand ourselves and our relationship with technology. And wherever we go, we can't understand that without being anthropological.
Yeah. So I think this is where we're actually, you know, our libraries are very different. And I went through a formal education in the Continental Philosophers. I'm much more aligned with the American pragmatists. And, you know, they're kind of a little universe of their own. You got this huge continental philosophy, and then you have the American pragmatists.
We've adopted them. The thing with Deleuze was that Deleuze taught us 50 years ago that Peirce, James, Dewey are geniuses. There's a great American tradition in parallel because he was a great fan of Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And Nietzsche was a pragmatist, believe it or not, he really was. So I started them too. I'm a huge fan. So they are part of my library. I want to point
that out. I wrote my BA thesis in philosophy on Nietzsche's Will to Power. So I spent a lot of time with him. But I'm just saying that in terms of the kinds of phraseology we use or how we connect the dots, I think underneath there's a lot of connections, and then there's questions that hopefully we can crisp up, because I think they're kind of just significant questions in how we envision this thing plays out. But we have different language games that we talk about. So I think the same thing. So let me just a second. I got to do something.
Sure, absolutely. That's where we're at, Andrew. Yes. This is great.
Yeah.
Think Related Foundation. And it's this mixed tradition of American pragmatism and continental philosophy. I don't know if it's part, at least, of continental philosophy, Hegel, Nietzsche onwards.
Okay, so should we talk metaphysics now?
Well, I'm curious about. Sorry if my questions are a little bit naive, because I'm not as well read in this philosophy as you guys, but I'm curious about the metaphysics of the pragmatists and the metaphysics of phenomenology, how they cross over and how they're the same.
Can I just first phrase why the metaphysics is difficult, so we get that?
Yeah.
Say you're a physicist, you're very likely to see the world through physics. You will always see the world through your own psychology. And when you get really good at something, you become your own archetype, fine. If you're a man, you're likely to see the world in a male way. If you're a woman, you're likely to see the world in a more feminine way. You are your archetype. And especially if you become an expert on something, which most people aren't in today's society. People are trained through capitalism to be absolute experts at what they do. That's how people make money and have a job to go to. Very few people can even afford to be generalists. And nothing is more general than metaphysics. It's totally general. So this is the difficulty. So say you're a biologist, you're likely to think the world through biology. So imagine if you're going to try to think metaphysics, try to understand how hard it is, you're like a biologist has to learn physics to not think biology when you do physics, but to think biology when you do biology. That also means you're trained to think metaphysics is a totally third different domain, where you must not assume that something you learned from physics or biology is applicable. Actually, the first thing you do in metaphysics, you kill axioms. You kill so many fucking assumptions you made about how the world operates. It's incredible. You have to kill and kill and kill and kill all the time. And that's why metaphysics is so hard, because most people take their own personal expertise and their own personality with them and throw that into the box and say, this is metaphysical. This is generally applicable in everything. And we're just like, I think Bonita agrees with me. You just sit there and say, no, wait a second. No, that's just you talking. That's you talking from your perspective, trying to force it onto the rest of the world. And that's where you have to train yourself. It's like you're a man, you have to try to think like a woman. It's like you're a woman, you have to try to think like a man. That's why it pays off to be shamanoid. It's a precondition to even try to do metaphysics, because you have to be so fucking curious, so fucking, you love to be wrong so much. You love to kill your axioms so much. You love to look at the world from the other side, the one you can already see, to even start to do metaphysics. I basically borrow this from American pragmatism, and we'll see what Bonito thinks of it. But my philosophy starts, like Deleuze and the pragmatist, my philosophy starts when shit happens. The only thing I'm certain of is that there's shit and there's things that happen. So the question is, what kind of shit are there? And what does it mean that something happens? And that means I can start philosophy right here and now with us, starting philosophy from here, which I think is the only decent place to start from, because otherwise you assume something in the past, you have no idea whether it ever exists, you start from there, or you assume some point in the future that you never know whether it's going to happen or not. At least we three tonight here are having this conversation, so we can start here. That's what I want to do, because I think it's the only honest point for where you can start metaphysics. And the first thing you then recognize is that your own psychology is going to be part of it. That's why it has to be a social project. It has to involve others. Otherwise, you can't do it. I don't know if Bonita agrees with me, but I think that's a good
start. I think that's one good... I could have said that, but I'll say two other ways of saying it. So metaphysics, there's an intellectual journey that makes a metaphysician, and that's similar to what Alex is saying. He talked about this, so I'm not going to do the psychological one. He touched the psychological and the intellectual. But the intellectual is like, you go to school and you blah, 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 and you're doing your biology and you learn. And then finally, you get to the point where you're reading about something that no biologist still understands or no physicist still understands. And you start to see there's a wall there. But the wall is not because you need more experiment. The wall is there because the question can't be framed. The way the question is framed is constrained. And so you have, so for example, the wall, the reason why Darwin was a genius is because people could only see change in terms of development, that the next higher form just developed from the previous higher form. And he could see how there could be these extinction events and stuff like that. And so a metaphysician quickly sees that the whole enterprise is constrained. And then you get interested in what is the constraint? How can I release that constraint? And then this is the creative aspect. How can I create a new way of understanding reality such that then it's the petri dish for new knowledge? And so the Deleuze and his interface and the rhizome, these are all metaphysical creations. So that's one thing. But for me, and this is more in terms of the American pragmatists, is that from there's this way in which you learn about the world, and you learn from other people, and it makes sense. But if you are like I described how I always been, but then you have your experience and you think, if you really see, most people can't really experience things in this kind of naive way, because their way, what the world has told them, is between them and experience. But if you've had this kind of transparency and you're like, wait, I don't really know if that's true. Like the way people taught me how to garden, it's all wrong. And the way people teach you how to train horses, it's all completely messed up. It's all because it's part of the industry and stuff like that. And you quickly learn that you have to, if you subtract what you assume to be the case, then there's a gap between actual lived experience and everything that is assumed to be the case. And so you have, you know, and this goes from very obvious examples, like when my mother didn't breastfeed because she was convinced, they convinced her that, you know, the human milk was dirty. And so in the spirit of the American pragmatist, the constraint is not between different intellectual containers and the curiosity of what lies beyond that, but the gap between, oh, what is actually the case, and the interpretive lenses that want to colonize your interpretation of that. And experience is always, I would argue, more in excess of any interpretive lens. And then when you're a metaphysician and you realize that, you realize there's no end to the creative enterprise, into mining experience for more rich and nuanced ways to underpin it intellectually.
This is what I meant with the world is axiomatic, and your own world is too. It's full of axioms, assumptions that actually you haven't really thought through and that have never been proven or anything. Just take it for granted. So one thing I borrowed from the pragmatist that I use throughout my work, you've discovered in Prose Event too, is that I use the word law as rarely as possible. Because the word law ties people into the axiom that, oh, somebody designed this, it has to be a certain way, it would be like that forever. And because law is a word introduced for humans to control other humans.
Yeah.
So we had to have law. As soon as we had larger populations than tribe, we had to have laws. And then people broke the law. And if they broke the law, they were punished or whatever, so the people would stay with the law. Then the law became this kind of sacred thing. And then we started assuming that nature must operate according to certain laws. Nature operates according, nature has habits. And some of these habits seem to be recurring. There are patterns, etc. What's great with Charles Sanders Peirce, the study basically banned the word law entirely and said they're just habits and we don't know whether they're anything more than habits. And that's a good starting point to start from there. And what's great with just thinking of habits is that habits can be more and more and more recurring. And when they're intensely recurring, we probably think of them as laws. And here's the trick. Then we're on to metaphysics because it's not a law in itself that it works that way. It's a principle. So, for example, from Quentin Melasu, I borrowed this one-liner or redefined this one-liner that says that the only meta-law we have is that there is no meta-law. Because we always look for a meta-law, like the law that controls all the other laws. And then we get the fucking hierarchy we think the world operates according to. And there's no such thing. They're just different shit that has happened. And we deal with some of these shits we are aware of or become aware of. We walk into walls and there's gravity and shit like that. The obvious shit we do not interact with as well. Very likely there was many types of shit. And I've proposed, for example, in this book that maybe we should split physics into two and call it subphysics and physics because there's so many irregularities within physics that it's very likely that physics is at least two different things that we're talking about that actually have no direct connection with one another. So This is why there could be domains like subphysics, physics, chemistry, biology, consciousness. I prefer the word subconsciousness because most of the time we're not very conscious of what we're doing at all. So have these different domains, discuss them separately as you would do in academics, and don't think that one thing you're discussing where you see a certain habit that starts to make sense, so you can study the phenomenon and make sense of it, is necessarily applicable in any of the others. There's no meta law. There's nothing that says if you learn something consciousness, then you must also find it in physics. No. No such thing.
There's no Ten Commandments. You can throw out the Ten Commandments completely.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Or just like, are these like fields of habits or something that reify and then they need to be updated or changed all the time? Or is there anything essential anywhere? Or, you know?
No. I'd say that most of the time when we study something, we actually discover truths, but then we discover deeper truths. And what we then have to do is that the overall story, the overall narrative has to be rewritten. It's not because the world has changed. It's because understanding of the world is different. And because, here I'm Nietzschean, because everything human beings do, including our own experiences of the world, goes through some kind of power relations. There's a Nietzsche and Wittgenstein agree, and I agree with them. The power relations involved in everything we do, we're constantly seeing powers of nature and powers of cultures are everywhere. And we cannot really engage in anything in the world without that lens of power structures being part of it. Then we certainly have to understand that's the precondition. So the narrative we write about ourselves at any given time will be reflected in the power structure on the specific society we live in. And if that power structure changes, which is bound to do over time, we'll start to look at the world differently. This is why my work is all about rewriting all of history as if the internet would happen one day, since I'm an internet philosopher. As if the internet would have happened, how would we then look at the world? Because then we start prioritizing the different shits and the different happenings in the past to make sense of the world today. And this kind of constant rewriting that's necessary is what we call transcendental emergentism. So this is my and Alexander Berlin's idea of doing metaphysics, fundamentally.
I think that, I mean, I would like to slow down here. So yes, there are power influences in what narratives in the human system become positively reinforced, right? Like, so positive, right? You know, the right brain keeps getting positively reinforced, etc. But I think let's go back to what you said at first. You call them principles, not laws. I call them protocols. And something that I envision, this is not in your work, I'm just going to set it out there so it's in your imagination, but because I do have a question about your vectoral analysis of emergence, which I found fascinating. I call them protocols, and my metaphysics includes this notion of, this is a little bit to answer your question, Andrew, this notion of that, there are, and this is consistent with your vectors, but it's like another chorus in the song that's not incompatible. But I'm in search of being able to articulate a gradient. So this would be subphysics, that there's a gradient. It's non-dualistic, but there is a gradient in which, so I call it a complex potential state, has a certain gradient. So some things are more likely to happen than others, but in the early Hist universe, these things cancel them out really fast. And it takes a long time for there to be a gradient that's asymmetrical enough for something for a vector to happen. That gradient asymmetry becomes, and so I think of the gradient like Gibson's ecological array in perception. Like, and I think of that gradient, I coined this term protension, that it's a tension, not like a stress tension to get away, but it's a tension to want, pro, to move toward. Like when you pull a string, it has a tension, and the tension is for it to move this way. And so I find this as the fundamental primordial purposiveness of the universe without a psychological component, and has a pro tension. Now, if you want to be classical physicist, you might say, well, the fundamental pro tension is that the initial state was very ordered, and the potential gradient is just to be entropic. Okay, I think that's too simplistic, but that would qualify as a protension. A protension gradient in your transcendental emergency might be this principle of vectorization. Has to be there. It doesn't have to be there from origin, but it becomes part of the ecological event early in time or early in space.
Yeah, true. Very likely. But the emergence vector theory disqualifies a general emergence theory. So here's the trick and how transcendental this actually is. We can't assume that there is a law for emergence before emergence happens. We always in hindsight, it's very Hegelian, but it's also pragmatist. We always in hindsight assume that certain things that have happened in history are more important than others. And this was by doing history, we discovered this, because we think in human history, since we're doing information technology philosophy, we're going to do spoken, written, printed, and interactive language as the four big paradigm shifts of history. And therefore, we also see very clearly that these four events that happened in history changed the world forever. And so we can then do metaphysics, which is, to start with, at least the history of the universe and probably more than that. We can then start doing that. And the strange thing then of the theory of doing paradigm theory or paradigmatics for human history, which is a much shorter time span, is that we can start to look at some, it's a principle again, we can start to look at all of history. It's like, so what would be the most important things that ever happened in history? At least from a human point of view today. Well, it's not that humans just came around, which is one thing, but you know, there are other things that have happened. We call them emergences. And by disqualifying the idea of a general emergence theory, we do not have any principle for what qualifies as an emergence beforehand. We're only saying that give us five or six things that happen after they were a fact that they existed. They seem to prolong. They seem to have some quality about them that made them prolong. Everything that existed before them certainly had an influence on them, which is why the universe is ultimately monist. And then when we look at these emergences now, we say that, well, the birth of physics and the birth of chemistry and the birth of biology, et cetera, at least from our point of view, must consider to be really, really important emergences. Each one of those emergences is unique. All the other vectors that already existed influenced them, and suddenly they were there. And we don't know why. There could be different reasons. So we don't have a general theory on what constitutes an emergence before it happens. We only in hindsight said afterwards, like Hegel did, and said, now in hindsight, we're saying that maybe there are similarities. But your potential idea is very interesting because it could qualify for all the emergences we know. They'll qualify for the current form of transcendental emergentism, but it would then be open to that maybe it wouldn't qualify for something we would have to call an emergence of something entirely new in the future.
Yeah. And so we're getting close to my questions coming. I think also emergence seem like emergent events and And I, you know, I don't know if you saw me, I was kind of poo-pooing emergencism, like the standard understanding of it. But one of the things that I think why when we look back and we see retrospectively these events is not only because things have added up. So as Vivekji would say, a difference in degree that makes a different kind. But there are also extinction events. So for example, when the human fetus is creating a hand, at first it's all webbed, right? And then the fingers emerge not only because they're adding to themselves, but this interstitial stuff gets subtracted. I call it substraction. We look back into the record and we not only see the events that are important that have been developed, but we subtract from the interstitial events that have seceded in order for the new occasion. And so that's something that is certainly consistent with what you're saying. But emergentism is not only this additive thing, but it's more evolutionary than development, because a lot of extinction events happen. And that's why when you look back, they seem so discontinuous and discrete, because it's concomitant with some of the interstitial events or processes, they would be processes, have receded. And then you get this sense of this discontinuous forms, let's say.
Oh, it's beautiful language too. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. An emergence is very likely to be the loss of something rather than the addition of something. Mm-hmm. It's much more likely than emergence. It's better to be considered as a loss of something suddenly gone, and therefore something else.
This is profound, because mm-hmm. there is the possibility that everything that we put on our stack today is scheduled, which I don't mean in a deterministic sense, contingently, to disappear. And you could look back and only see matter again. I mean, these are all possibilities in the field of metaphysics, for sure.
I like this idea because normally we think we're adding on to reality, right? But the taking away is equally as important as the adding on. My question is, like, if you know, as things are, you know, as emergence would be like things disappearing and things arising, is there a clarifying process where we're actually learning something, or is it just change?
But once again, don't go into general emergence theory. Try to ban it and keep it out.
Okay.
The thing is that we often look through the world through the old eye, because the old eye writes the book and has the wisdom. We lose our entire lives. Things die all the time. We go old. We hopefully get wiser as we go, before we get demented, of course. But we hopefully get wiser through life experience. We get older, the more knowledge, the older we are. Bonita and I, probably, at least, maybe you, Andrew, too, is at our peak, right? Our peak knowledge in our lives, or peak wisdom, whatever. I don't know. But, you know, but we also lose an energy. This is the love between the old and the young. The young have the energy, the old have the wisdom. But if you look at the world through the eyes of old age and wisdom, and you still want to live, so you want to go at an old age and have to look forward to be old, then of course you assume that there's some kind of development, things are added all the time. But what I loved working with Cadell last, and his great contribution to process event, to point that out repeatedly, was to introduce the term negatology as a precondition for eventology. So assume that eventology was born in Persia 3,700 years ago. We have no evidence whatsoever that anybody ever thought development or progress of any kind before then. Before then, all thought was nomadological, which means it was just process and repetition, repetition, repetition. Okay, there's repetition, but there's also difference. Okay, so difference then, fundamental difference that always existed when things were repeated, was death. People died, things died, things were lost. So what do you call it? Subtraction?
Subtraction.
There's a little extra stuff. That makes it a good philosophy word. It's a good spelling test for it.
Because it relates to both the fact that something is subtracted, but when we look at the past, we abstract. So it's subtraction.
Subtraction is a great word to add to negatology.
And it's also
we take away
the substrate. The interstitial. So this
is a great word to add to a negatology. A negatology is basically a nomadological precursor to an eventology. So if there was a possibility to think the event, although nobody did, before technology started taking off and the world radically became different, which is why the Persians invented this 3,007 years ago, and why that idea stayed and became part of a new power structure in its mythology. What happened was that negatology was always there. People died. And how did you explain that away? Well, that person is dead, sure, and grandmother is gone, but that person over there is becoming the new grandmother because she's the new archetype of that person. So the archetypes were inherited all the time. That's what reincarnation is. There's nothing wrong with reincarnation, but reincarnation is not a reincarnation of you, because your memory is certainly eradicated when you're demented, not even when you die. You're like, your memory is dead, and yourself is dead the second you're demented. So you're gone, and if you're gone, the question is, who then inherits your archetype? And this is where master and student, etc., everything in any sort of processual culture is constantly about learning a certain trait so that trait can be passed on the next generation. So when the older generation dies, the younger generation takes over. This is how life comes and goes, and that's nomadology. But here's the trick. By introducing death and then taking death seriously, I think something genuinely that's valuable to us actually dies, and it might not be replaced, is actually how the thinking about the event starts. Because the non-event, the anti-event, is the first event because it was there all along. And suddenly technology comes along. And of course, technology steps in and fills gaps and things people can't do any longer can suddenly be done through technology or whatever. And because technology has this capacity, more than anything, technology is information technology. And when written language appears, it must have been totally magical as people started seeing what it could do, because you could write your own story and you could die and the story would still be there. An eternal version of yourself could still be there because something was written down. And this must have been so magical. And of course, knowledge was passed on from one generation to the next. Knowledge accumulated for the first time ever. This is the thinking of the event. But please notice, it starts with something lacking. It always starts with a void of some kind.
Yeah, so a couple of things. So this is very Whiteheadian in a different way. You know, a lot of people say that Whitehead ripped off Pierce and who knows, but so in process philosophy you have potentials and you have actuals. This is a simplification. We're in our weeds more sophisticated than this, and both potentials and actuals are infinite, but they're not exhaustive. So for example, there was once a time when there were no elephants, and there may be a time when there are no more elephants, but there will never be a time when there were no elephants. That actuality is taken out of the potential state. And this is what you're saying. So it actually matters because it reduces a fundamental profile of the universe. There will never be a time when there is never any elephants. There will never be a time when there was never an Alexander Berg. And so this is what you're saying. It gives you this sense of that there's something written in the record forever because of this fundamental equation between actuals and potentials gets, you know, the potentials, the actuals get reduced, but they're still infinite, you know, like Cantor sets.
Yeah, the way Hegel phrased that, it's that Hegel would say that the past is a necessity, but the future is a contingency.
Yeah.
And exactly. This is why I take the P and the A here. I take it out of the third, which is the V, which I take from Deleuze, who was supposed to hate Hegel, but he's intensely Hegelian. So by having three, it makes it easier, because always when you do narrative and you do time, you can do the now, a specific category, and then you have the past and then you have the future. What's great then is that if you turn that around, so if you turn around the time axis, you get first virtuality, then potentiality, then actuality. And what's interesting with that idea is that potentiality is the now. And in the now, actually, history is not definite yet. It isn't fixed yet. There is a moment. It's obvious that the contingency of the future enables enormous freedom. Hegel was adamant about this. Hegel said that we have enormous agency, we have enormous freedom, because we are part of a contingent world and we're collaborating and we're engaged in that world, and our thoughts can even affect everything else. So he was totally right about that. He's the precursor of TE next to the privatist. So, but the great thing about having the V is that the problem Alexander Vredelung and I had is that the word potential includes the idea of potency. And we were really trying to think of Whitehead, like, what does it mean that something, we call it subsistence because it doesn't exist, at least not yet. What if something just can think, we can think of something as it subsists, but it has no existence, so it has no potency, at least on its own. So we could, for example, think something prior to relations that could be part of a relation. So a relation can be thought in hindsight, like a relation of any kind can be thought of as a different elements involved in the relation. Since it's a relation, it's a pluralist. And these different virtualities get potentiality out of their interaction with each other.
So
you could allow to virtualities to basically think of it out. To virtualities, it's hyper type. It's really weird to think this way. But think about two virtualities clash and collide, and suddenly they get potency from each other. And this actually is a really valuable idea in some physics and physics. Higgs bosons and things like that work that way. And then a potentiality, we thought, for example, as a field is potentiality, and the particle is the actuality. So the actuality is that the historical fact undeniably there after the event, after the now, whatever is left, whatever is necessary to acknowledge as the past, which will not be changed. The past can never be changed, not altered. And in this sense, what is there in the past is where the actual occurs.
You're going to change your interpretation of the past, though, right? Like, you guys are very pre-axial in your view, rather than situating the axial age as the center. Or
No. This is a thing. Very, very important distinction. A good question, Andrew. You cannot change the past, period, right? Yeah. What you can do is change your narrative about who you are today, because reflecting yourself from the past as part of a historical process, you will shift the priorities of that historical process in understanding who you are today. This is why we're saying nobody in the Stone Age or whatever thought about the internet. We're not saying that. We're saying that Stone, Bronze, and Iron Age were applied onto history in the 19th century by people who build industries. No Stone Age person ever thought they lived during the Stone Age. So we always rewrite history in hindsight, but we don't change history. We literally just rewrite it to understand who we are now.
And this is the problem. And I know this is in agreement with you, Alexander. So if I say it differently, we should hash that out. Because what people do is inevitably the lens you take on when you look at the past is different than the being composition orientation you have to live in the present forward. It's just different. And so when we look at the past, to the point that we can call it the past, right? It's experience of pasting, okay? We are looking at discrete events because the institutional stuff has, you know, because these things have augmented, but mostly also because the interstitial stuff has gone away. And then as human beings, we say, oh, there's too much discontinuity. And we create little narrative arcs, which are stories, to put the events together. And this is the construction of demi-reality. So we look at the past, oh my God, these events are discontinuous. Let me rate, you know, like we look at the archaeological record and we see a little bit of pot here and a stone there, and then we make a narrative. And these little narrative constructions can change over time because they're fundamentally delusions in the first place.
Or they're speculative or something.
Right? Listen. Bonita, I agree with you, but I wasn't here to solve a problem.
I'm not here to solve a problem.
I'm here to create more problems. I'm a philosopher.
No. Okay, but here's the thing. And then we look at the past and
we create
these narratives, and then we say, the past is canalized because this.
I know.
And then no freedom. Whereas Hegel says, or I'm going to say Hegel says, the fact that these things get pulled out of existence is why you have freedom. You could kill your identity today, and then there's just freedom. And so this notion of things being pulled out of existence is really important principle. And then I still haven't asked your question, but do you see the difference what I'm saying?
I know, but this is why we are next in this book doing narratology. This is how difficult it is to
create narratology. In other words, what is a narrative?
It's okay.
Right.
We are suggested is that Hegel succeeded in uniting ontology and epistemology. We're active agents in the world. The pragmatists and Nietzsche both agree. If that means that epistemology, learning the world, is actually being in the being in the cell time, then at least ontology and epistemology should be united into one discipline, onto epistemology. That means we have one less discipline to deal with, or one less emergence factor to deal with in philosophy. We can therefore afford, after 100 years of real hard attempts at doing deconstruction, to maybe allow narratology to be a philosophical discipline. I think actually that narratives, since narratives is what we have, but the different types of narratives, I think narratives need to be understood as philosophical discipline. What we then do is that we're saying that there is no stable point of one truth anywhere for the simple reasons that human beings have to do narratology in three different ways. One of them is called logos, one of them is called pathos, and one of them is called mythos. And here's the thing with the logos can only be applied onto the past because it's connected to the necessity of the past. You can never apply the logos on now, and you can never apply logos on the future. The future is contingent, so you cannot apply logos on the future. Just stop it. Stop assuming that the future is determined. It isn't. It can't be, and it won't be. Okay. So determinism collapses it now. And a word that Hegel never had but should have had is what we call transdeterminism. So you can say that everything looks like it if it was determined until now as much as you like, although you were part of creating it, at least the first 20 years of your life, whatever. So you're there now. But you cannot apply any sort of determinism onto the future. It's clearly indeterminist, although I don't use the two terms because determinist and indeterminist are sloppily used because they're really local phenomena, local characteristics. A phenomenon can, for example, be both determinist and indeterminist at the same time. So collapse both. Transdeterminism means basically we throw the idea of determinism and determinism, the division, out of the window because it's dysfunctional, won't work. It's false. It's a false division. So instead, what we have is that we have the logos, which you can only apply on the past. For example, data is always data about the past. There are no data about the future, and there never will be, period. So data processing, for example, AI, can only deal with the past. Therefore, it can only repeat the past, or repeat the past, repeat the past. It cannot do anything else because it's the past. Data is from the past. Logos, right? Logos is always overdone, usually by men, aggressively against women, because women are much more mythical than men are. Women beat the men back by being mythical, because mythos actually is more true than logos is to you, most human beings, because we are mythical creatures. The mythos is right in the now. And the pathos is what we apply into the future. We sort of feel our way passionately towards the future and try to make sense of it. And I mean, we go and kill ourselves if we don't have a pathos. If our pathos dips towards the future, we go and kill ourselves. We have to have some kind of path to the future where at least the potential for that pathos to go in a certain direction, which we will find, you know, nice, and we want to be part of it, right? So without hope, we go and kill ourselves. So, but the pathos is tied to the contingency. So the pathical narrative is tied to contingency. The logical narrative can only deal with the digital past. And the mythical narrative is the only possibility to unite the other two. And you can only unite them temporarily. Truth can only be temporary in the sense truth is always mythical, deepest sense. Like I said, no matter what I write as a philosopher, you will always find a Shakespeare play that's truer to what it means to be human than anything I would ever write as a philosopher. An artist will always be closer to what it truly means to be human than a philosopher, a mathematician, whatever could ever be. This is what I mean with the mythos. And here we have already set up three different meta-narratives. And here's the point. They're all irreducible to one another. That means there's no one truth ever. Dead. Because truth in itself, it can both be, are you truth to yourself?
And there's three truths.
At least three truths at all times. What's great with doing that, basically laying that out, is like there are at least three truths at all times. And don't mix them up. And I think that's where I pointed out to what Benito just commented on. We're going to have problems with people when I say what I just said. Well, it's just because they mistake one meta-narrative for another one.
All right. Can you respond to what he said? We have three irreducible narratives, see? I'm with you. And I think this is also Yes, I agree with. I think that there's something definitely, the irreducibility of things. There's a lot in this, like the irreducibility of the lens. You have to look at the past and lens. You're just saying there are two different irreducible narratives, and I call them
lenses. Irresistible narratives. That was a good slip.
Well, they're irresistible too. And yeah. I just call them, we have to compose ourselves in a different, certain orientation to say past, to not even before we tell a story about it. And so we're orienting toward the logos when we are pasting, and we're orienting toward the pathos when we are futuring, and we are orienting as, I would say, not toward, as the mythos when we're.
It's kind of nice to really understand mythos as that's how I would describe any sense of now I ever had. It was mythical because there was so many things going on I had no understanding of. There's so many mysteries around me all the time. A few things I do understand, and it seems to work that I do certain things with a certain agency.
Yeah.
It's the combination of the three. But if you try to define the existential experience itself, it can only have a mythical description. And you know it's only a temporary description. I mean, the first thing you say, where are you at right now? Well, I think I'm at this state right now. I'm emotionally here. I'm sort of logically here, rationally here. I'm sort of, but the only way you write a narrative and put it together, especially with your friends, and then it's a shared narrative about where you're at the moment. And you, of course, assume you're allowed to change the story, what actually happened Tuesday at 7 o'clock in the evening, because 3 days later you say, oh, What was really going on Tuesday in my mind and around me last Tuesday was not at all what I thought at the time.
Yeah. So I mean, I think we have the sense of this triadic structure or triad, but I'm going to say in my work, just so we get to know each other better, but it may be a resonance, it may be something. So the word mythical means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I would say that what you just described, for me, it's not archetypal. That's too repetitive for me. It's not Jungian. And so I borrow the term lyrical from Jan Zawicki. And lyrical means it's the cognitive operation of the musicality of life. So for example, when I'm listening to an orchestra, I have to have a lyrical kind of attention, because where is the music? Is it the first note? Is it at the third note? It is afterwards? No, it's there and not there at the same time. It's whole and in process at the same time. So I call that, to me, that middle thing is a lyrical culture or a lyrical orientation. I don't call it mythical, because for me, mythical.
I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. This is great. I totally agree. The problem is that the Greeks had not invented the word lyros yet. So they had mythos. So because we have the mythos and we have the logos and we have the pathos in Greek.
Isn't mythical
sort of contains a notion of time going from the past to the future and the creation of various characters that move through. And what you're talking about is this sort of timeless experience that where you fall out of time.
Benita is right that the word myth means an awful lot of things. And again, this is about the instrument.
Alex was doing, he was going like this. And this is like what a musician is doing in an orchestra, and it's there, and you have to have your hands on it.
I am a musician, so
I know the intention
before I listen to music piece is the virtuality, because the music is not even there, right? The potentiality of the music is every note I hear, one note by the next note or whatever I perform. And the actuality is the whole experience of the musical piece. clearly, it makes sense to do VPA on a music piece, for example. So we can apply VPA. But the mythical, what I mean with the mythos, EPA, let's just use the word mythos here. Lyrical is good.
EPA is not EVT. What's EPA?
VPA. VPA is virtuality, potentiality, actuality.
Okay, VPA, right.
So it's how we relate to now. We relate to now about virtuality because just nothing there. I just
forgot what the letters
were. But the potentiality, because of its potency, is where the now is at. And actuality is only the historical fact afterwards. So it's the switching of the contingency and the necessity around the other way.
Yeah.
So that's what we presumed. For example, just apply it on the music piece. And music is incredibly direct. That's why it's a great example, because the music experience is, it's absolute emotional. It's there right away. That's why I love doing it for 25 years, because after having done that work with direct experience, I have to work with something incredibly indirect, which was philosophy. So it was a good move to go from music to philosophy for me. Alex Ebert is attempting to do exactly the same thing, the journey from a rock star to becoming a philosopher.
But if you think about it, when you're listening to music, you can catch your mind trying to remember what just, like, oh, that was a really beautiful phrase. So I'm stuck a little in the past. And then now you're in the music again. And then if it's a good musician, you start to time travel. Like, where is it going to go? And you can actually feel these three orientations or these three narratologies you're being kind of,
it's like a mediator, out. Mediator of some kind between the pathos and the logos, or it's like.
This is the point. The idea of music itself is the mythical aspect of it, or the mythos aspect of it, whereas the logos is the actual notes and the performance and the hitting the instrument, or whatever, and the pathos is how I relate to it emotionally. As a musician, I feel while I play. That's what a live performance is all about. I'm jumping between the pathos and the logos constantly. The mythos, though, is between me and the audience. It's occurring in the room while I'm performing. The mythos is clearly social. That's why, here's another complex thing.
Well, the mythos is social. That's another thing.
This is why we have three brains in psychoanalysis. O'Gurlian's idea of the three brains. I love this idea because it's actually very helpful in treating psychiatric disease, which means it's a really good theory. Good in so many ways. But the idea of us having a rational brain, an emotional brain, a mimetic brain is interesting because that means the mythos that we use here, strictly here's the Greek term, lyrical. We could perfectly happy with that. The lyrical experience of the now is actually tied to mimetic, which means it's tied to social. The now is intensely a social experience.
And the mimetic is tied to somatic.
Somatic. So the word, the mythos, discursively used to the use as not logos, not pathos, is tied to mimetic. Means, for example, I go on a date with a woman, I don't know, it would be bonita, she might disagree and she might be different from other women, most women at least, will go on a date and they will sit in the middle of the date and have the strongest moment when they look me in the eye and they say, I don't feel you're really present here. And you know what I tell them, bonita? I tell them, darling, that's your job. I'm a man. I'm either in the past.
Oh, I was just going to say.
In the now. You're a woman. You're in the now because you're more mimetic.
Actually, I was going to say, I never say that to be men. I figure out ways to make them present.
You never say it. You just find ways to do it.
No, there is Marita, but because I am present, because when it comes to the presence of the date, she does the tango and I follow.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I do. If they're starting to drift, there's always a way to, like, you know, catch their. Anyway,
you've discovered the secret way man loves to go on a date with a woman.
I'm agreeing that I take it on as my responsibility, not as their responsibility, and I blame them for it. Yeah. I actually enjoy the challenge. And yes. Okay.
Great. So do I, because I love that moment when that happens. And I love what I have to say. It's always great to tell somebody, no, you're the strong one here, but I'll try to dance with you. I'll try to follow me into your presence. Because why would I go on a date with a woman if I didn't love your presence? You know, it's where it's at. But there's something to that. It's very general. Even trans men and trans women agree with me on this theory that there's something fundamental to splitting up the young. That's why I don't do yang and yin. I do yang and yong and then yin, in the sense that there's a conflict in the mask in the masculine brain between the rational and the emotional, because they're both boiling over, and a mimetic brain is often far lower engaged, and therefore men have problems with social intense environments compared to women, where the mimetic brain dominates in the traditional female brain. And women, because the mimetic brain works, they can outsource in a different way, and therefore they use less of the rational and emotional brains. So this works in psychiatry. It works in understanding between men and women in psychiatry and understanding the different predicaments they might be stuck with as well. So it's a very general theory. It's again, a philosophical suggestion to play with. It's not meant to be like a curse on anybody whatsoever. At the end of the day, human beings and human society operates according to the full narratology. But what it opens up to is my critique of what men do wrong in history, which is not create patriarchies. I think patriarchy is a beautiful word to be saved, like matriarchy. Rather, what men do wrong in history, would men either go off of one of the two brains and become a pillar saint, which is the logos dominates, the pathos is being pushed down, or become boy pharaohs, which is the pathos dominates, the logos is being pushed down. And that's when you don't have the balance between the logos and the pathos in the power structure, you have major problems.
That's
why the priest and the king are separate archetypes.
It's true for women too. Anything that is not that in dynamic protension or dynamic balance, you get distortions of selves, right? This is Gurdjieff's. Just, you know, every Enneagram is not a typology; it's a distortion of the true self. So, can you please do me a favor, Andrew? I'm too scared to ask Alex for a favor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would like to end with my question, and maybe we could pick the question up next time.
All right.
Sure.
What's your question?
Well, because it's a legitimate curiosity about EVT, emergent vector theory. Okay. And to do that, I would like to show a drawing because it's way too hard to ask at a meta level. Could I possibly do that?
Sure.
Please.
You'd have to let me share my screen.
Okay.
So I'm just going to show the drawing for a second, and then we can riff on it, because I only read almost all of chapter 9. I skipped to the end, but the beginning I was very interested in. And underneath what you were saying, I was hoping you would find something I'm playing with. It was almost like, is he saying what I think he's saying? And that would be really cool.
So we're going to have Alexander Riedeling next time we talk, definitely.
Yeah, that's why I thought it'd be great if we put the question on the screen.
Yes, okay. Agreed.
Okay, so here's the stupid little drawing. It's not, you know, I just did it so we could talk. So I love your concept of subphysics. We can start there. And then, okay, I think you guys say there's space before time. Hawking says, no, you say there's time before space. Hawking says there's space before time. I don't want to argue about that. And so somehow there's a vector, and then there's space-time, okay? Now we have these vectors, energy, matter, life, mind, whatever you want to put there. I'm not saying this is the way yours go, okay? Now, here's the question. Here's the metaphysical question. It's my debate, ongoing debate with Greg Enriquez. Most people think, let's say you get to matter, and the matter starts to complexify to the point where you get emergence of life. Oh, it should be down here. Sorry. This line should be down here. See what I'm saying? This line should go down here. And then life complexifies to the point where you get mind. And then mind complexifies to the point where you get something else. This is what most people think, right?
Yes.
You notice my line shouldn't have gone there. My line should have gone straight down to life. And then life complexifies to the point you get mind. And it continues.
And then you get enlightenment or something.
Right.
The question
what I'm suggesting is that the subphysics is actually what mutates. That life does, that mind is not at some mutation off this line, but that the subfixes or the virtual, what I call complex potential states is more like your virtual, that the mutation happens along this, and then you get mind. That it looks like life complexifies to a point where mind emerges, but what's happening is in the subphysics. And well, that
here's the problem with Greg's theory, although he's not here. He thinks we jump from one thing to the next. We do not. In transcendental emergentism, everything that is inexistent in existence in a modest universe affects an emergence.
To qualify right, that's what I'm saying. The mutations are in the subphysics, and then you get these. So, for example, we at one point we had life, and then we have mind. Okay, and what I was saying to Greg is that we don't have there's life, and then what emerges the nature of mind, and you could define it as whatever you want. I would say the nature of mind is to run a simulate the environment, and we can see this in crows, and we can see this in higher animals. They can run simulations, they can run hypothetical simulations of the environment. As far as we know, only humans can simulate their self, and only humans then can speak to each other's simulation. So that's another mutation. But what I'm saying is that this mutation happens, and then you see that it starts to complexify along the animal mind. And then another mutation happens, and we can simulate ourselves, and then that complexifies. And if that complexifies into, now this is where we're going to have an argument, and that is if it complexifies into artificial intelligence, I would not expect the mutation to happen on that line, but something that we can't even imagine. So this is what I'm very... Well,
I don't do the line. I'm not with the... That's Greg. That's not me. I don't have the line.
Well, you have the vectors.
The thing is why I'm saying constantly and repetitively that there's no general emergence theory. Stop thinking that emergences are occurring in the same way as if there was a law for emergence before they happened. We have
somehow,
to understand.
Yeah, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah. Greg's model, Greg and I have agreed on categories that are very helpful. So in that sense, he's a psychologist, I'm a psychoanalyst, we can work together. But I would say that one thing doesn't come out of one thing only. Everything that comes into existence comes out of absolutely everything in that universe affecting it.
Right.
In every way possible. In every way possible. I'm totally with Whitehead and David Bohm that the universe is fundamentally modest. From what we know,
right.
It could be a universe that wasn't modest. We don't know of any such universe yet. No sign of it whatever. So from what we know historically in emergence, that is, for example, emergence could also be that something is lost or dies. And because of a void, something right. occurs. But we have to define it for ourselves as human beings, which because we write a history, we have to define it as something absolutely dramatic and revolutionary to us. And the point we're doing transcendental emergentism is to finally kill reductionism. Right. Reductionism is the enemy. Men go off and either because they got a brain that's bigger than their body, they think that everything is about the consciousness. So because the body is stronger than the mind, they think everything is about physics or whatever. And they try to use everything down to the fucking atom or all the way up to themselves. Both wrong. You can't reduce the world to an extreme. That's where it's wrong.
That's what Harman called reducing upwards.
Yeah.
The mind is thus hyper complex, and everything gets reduced upwards to that.
Reductionism is all the way down to the atom, and it turns out the atom wasn't the end game anyway. But we call that one reversed reductionism, which is all the way up to consciousness, which always turns out to be the thinker himself, doesn't it? Yeah. Right? So both wrong. What we do instead is say, okay, let's take emergence seriously. And other thinkers like Adrian Johnston, Terence Deacon, over the last 30 years have taken emergence seriously. And what we propose, they've still gone into different forms called dialectical materialism and transcendental materialism. Just using the word material reduces the fucking materia again. No, it's better to just keep emergence as a simple metaphysical principle, period. Shit happens, period. No materia, no consciousness, nothing applied to it. Purely metaphysically thinking it. And if that's the principle we're thinking, then we can say that, okay, whatever exists now and all of history up until now, very likely the future too, because this is what we at least as human beings would regard as. There are some dramatic shifts in history that we have to, say, qualify as proper emergences. And whatever came out of them, that lasted for as long as it lasted. It could also have an end date, and certainly the universe probably will too. Whatever lasted, we called it an emergence vector. It right. deserves to be studied on its own merits.
Right.
That's the point we're doing, T. It's incredibly underwhelming, as most people say when they get it. It's great, because my experience is that great metaphysics for the past 3,000 years has been underwhelming, because it kills axioms, things people take for granted, they should not take for granted, including reducing everything to this one thing.
Right.
So are you killing integral here? Are you killing the whole integral, you know, theory?
I don't
know.
The integralists have to respond to that. I do transcendental emergentism. Ken Wilber loves my work. I'm great with the Wilberians and all that, but there's no objective spiral or anything like that in my work ever. That's Marxo-fascism over here, to be honest about it.
I think your conversation is giving me some insight into the critique of spiral dynamics and all
okay,
that.
Okay, we've never ever thought of that we should moralize or anything like that at all. I try to stay out of, I never do good and bad or good and evil or whatever. I just don't do it. It's philosophically dishonest. But I'd say the great thing about doing TE and working with and then starting applying it on people, including human history, which then consists of certain paradigms, like, what are the most important things that happened? Not to you, but to humanity over the past 100,000 years. Okay, that and that and that are the most important thing. Great. Let's see if the paradigms apply to that. Can we have some simple principle? We can. For example, if the amount of information available for human processing explodes, it probably qualifies as a new paradigm, speaking from the information technological perspective. Oh, that turns out to be when we started talking. That turns out we started writing. That turns out to be when we started printing and creating the huge cost, you know, cheap libraries. And suddenly we have the internet. And God, wow, so much data. We're overwhelmed. Yeah, it's got to be confusing, long, confusing dialectical process. Digital Libido wrote about this, a dark 50, 100 years ahead. But after that, could be heavenly, could be amazing, because we'll have access to more information than ever before. And we'll actually be forced to be more honest with each other at the end of the day because of the algorithms. Great. So once you train people to think that way historically, they don't reduce history to some beginning. They don't reduce it to some endpoint. They can do history from right where they are right now, and they can really enjoy diversity, difference, and be more tolerant.
So is this a remedy to all this like doomer stuff?
Each person deserves to be studied as that person is, instead of just applying general theories onto human beings constantly.
Would you say that EDT then would help, like, you know, so many people are in social media and they just, all these blips every day seem to be like pivotal things. And then you could say, well, no, that's just noise. What are the deeper kind of signals that come less frequently? What's deeper than that? Then what's deeper than that? I would say that's metaphysics, you know?
That's why I said anthropology is now where metaphysics is at.
Yeah.
I think psychoanalysis have way out of that, because when you're then analyzing society and try to understand it from an artistic point of view, because I think that's more honest, try to understand it scientifically, because there's always goes wrong, then I call it social analysis. I'd say social analysis is one. It's like, it's a bit of a yin-yang relationship in the sense that social analysis and anthropology is where metaphysics is at. And metaphysics makes sense and it's incredibly fruitful to work with, because metaphysics must be the underlying, what can we say about the underlying conditions for doing anything else on top of it when we're going to do social analysis and anthropology? Maybe social analysis is more of the masculine, anthropologist more of the feminine. I always thought anthropologists, women are great at it. It's kind of what women do when they do philosophy. They become anthropologists. Again, the mimetic brain takes over. It's beautiful. And Chris Deva, Paglia, Hannah Arendt, all my favorite female philosophers, Karen Barrett, they're all anthropologists, definitely. And I think that you're right. I think coming out of this conversation, I think anthropology is the excuse to do metaphysics. And in a way, anthropology is metaphysics today. Cool.
So, Bonita, are you satisfied with what Alexander said? Is that maybe that's
No, word, I mean, but... I would like to start again with the EVT. And I think that right now there is a discussion around, you know, emergentism. Brendan has that book, Greg's Emergence. Mm-hmm. And I think that underneath a lot of these expressions, I think people are inclined and available to a kind of more nuanced metaphysics called EVT. We could call it EVT. It doesn't matter.
It opposes general emergence.
It needs to be better articulated so then people can like come on board, because I think that this popular version of emergence is just like, oh, you have this taxonomy and then emergence happens, like God went in there and tickled something. And I don't think this is philosophically or scientifically rigorous. And I think, like I said, I didn't understand all of EVT from what I read in chapter 9, but I have the sense that this is a very good piece of metaphysics to talk about.
EVT opposes general emergence theory. So instead of doing general emergence theory, we have emergence vector theory. Once you've done emergence vector theory, the next question is, so can you then say anything, even if each emergence vector deserves to be understood on its own, and there are no relations between the emergence vectors except the existence of the same universe, and you cannot take one emergence vector and apply what you learned from another one? That's cheating. You can't. You can't understand biology through physics. You have to learn biology separately. For example, so the idea is to avoid the very boyish jumping to conclusions of thinking emergence. Oh, we have a general emergence theory. No, you do not. You don't have a creator God. You're not allowed to put a creator God in there who designed laws for how emergence would occur, as if emergence was something that was decided beforehand. Emergence is always created by us human beings in hindsight. This is Hegel. Always created by us in hindsight to make sense of and locate ourselves in the world we're at right now. It's the only way to do decency. And therefore, EVT is the opposite of general emergence theory and alternative. It's the opening towards an alternative understanding of emergence without doing the general. This is why we call it transcendental emergentism. That's precisely why we do that.
Well, this reminds me of Bashgar and Andrew brought in integral theory, because Bashgar said integral theory is not a theory, it's a taxonomy, because there's no theory of why these things move. Like there's no, and if EVT is a theory and not a taxonomy, however underwhelming a theory it might be, I think that would be very good to suss out, because that's exactly what Roy Bashgard said to Wilbur. It's not a theory, it's a taxonomy.
It's very Hegelian. When Hegel is at his best, when he's doing method, it's very Hegelian. Right. It's just, this is what can be said, and that's the absolute. This is the end of it. You can't say more than that. That's Hegel's absolute. Hegel's absolute is always that, but you can't say more than that. Try to say more than that. You're out there. You've lost it. This is where the possibility of saying something, your ontopistemology ends here, because the world changes again, apparently. So the transcendental here is the opposite of general. So what we're saying, something could happen, like God could probably appear. Oh, there's a God here. Oh, atheism was right. But it turns out atheism is no longer applicable because God exists. Okay. If God exists, it certainly qualifies as an emergence, I think. Then, of course, all of emergence theory has to be rewritten. But at least the emergence vector that existed before could at least defend themselves as being for whatever they are. But they have to be understood differently, because the transcendentality of the new emergence, God certainly occurs, means that the entire theory has to be written. And this is where TE, transcendental emergence, is the only thing we can say metaphysically that stays. It's the only way of doing metaphysics that's applicable on the future as well. That's where it stops. It's understanding the beauty of what Hegel absolutely means with the absolute. That's my point. And Hegel should be unified with the pragmatists. Oh God, Peirce is the American Hegel.
Well, I'll keep reading before the next one.
I will. I'm going to Bhaskar. That's a good example who I should return to, actually, before we do our next conversation.
Yeah, and you know, he was, relative to the integral community, he was extremely continental in feel. So
yeah, I know. I've read Bhaskar. I've returned to Bhaskar. That's a good return for me.
And he has a whole book on Hegel, which you sound very much like. Because it's a more sophisticated interpretation of Hegel.
Can I add, I love this conversation.
Oh yeah, I think Alexander, you're shining in this conversation, both you guys. I think it was incredible. I hope my questions are on point, because I do feel like I'm on the edge at all times listening to you, which is a cool place to be.
I love Bonita for all kinds of things, but I love Bonita because she really makes an effort in understanding these things. And I will certainly return the favor by making an effort in understanding what Bonita's up to. And I love meeting a proper living Whiteheadian, always.
Okay, so next time we'll do it with Alexander.
You have to say Neo Whitehead, because like the very like strong Whiteheadians that are very strict Whiteheadians, they would not, even as Isabella Stangers is a...
No, you're a proper Whiteheadian. Neo. That's what you mean. You're the proper one.
Exactly.
The daughter of Whitehead, yeah.
You're the real Whitehead.
I'll just add one thing. One of my favorite thinkers in America is Manuel de Landa. I highly recommend him. He's the American Deleuze. And you know what the funny thing is? It was only a few years ago, I was having a conversation with him, and he shocked me and said he never studied Whitehead. He only studied Deleuze. And then I said...
Oh, I thought you were going to say he only studied Simon Dan,
Yeah, he did. But a Mexican shaman who missed Whitehead and still thinks like fucking Whitehead means Whitehead and Deleuze are so damn similar.
Yeah.
That it's just shocking. It's fantastic. Great, great stuff. All of the nerds in our community
are going to adore this conversation, I'm sure. It was fantastic. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. We'll do the next one. Okay, we got our mission, and I'll read some more.